Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, the place where over 1,000 entrepreneurs have come to tell the stories of how they built their businesses, had challenges along the way, overcame them or not, and mostly told you what they learned from it. And thousands and thousands and thousands of other entrepreneurs have listened and learned and used what they've learned from these interviews. Today's guest is David Baggett. He co-founded ITA Software, a company that Google bought for a reported $700 million. ITA made software that makes still software that that's the search engine behind sites like Kayak. It actually figures out prices, time, and other data of flights. Today, after selling, he launched and is running Inky, a mobile app that makes clearing your inbox easier. It will categorize your email for you, it will help you unsubscribe from junk, and it will let you quickly respond to what's important. I invited him here to talk about his past companies, and personally, as a guy who gets a lot of email and doesn't want to waste time on it, I want to ask him about Inky, including a couple of challenging questions that some of you might have. I think this is the right app for me, but I have one big question that we'll talk about later on. All right. First, I should say this interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker. Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Later on, I'll tell you more about him, but I've got to welcome David. David, thanks for doing this.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
You sold. It's $700 million. Which bank account is it in?
Yeah, it's in checking. I have it all in checking.
I thought so. Do you ever go to the ATM, look at it, and go, like, print out a receipt and go, $700 million. I did it.
Yeah, usually it doesn't work that way. I mean, when you have this kind of exit, you know, lots of people are involved, and you know, we raised $100 million, so that we had investors that own more than half the company. So there's a lot of dilution anytime you get an exit that big. I mean, there are a few counterexamples to that. I'm sure Facebook, you know, that was a big one for Mark Zuckerberg. But usually when you have a big exit or a big IPO, it's been carved up into lots and lots of little pieces.
Are there so many pieces that right now you have to get a job at the local Wendy's while you're building this app?
No, it's not like that. I mean, I can self-fund Inky, and that's what I've been doing so far. And obviously, you know, any kind of exit like that is life-changing at some level. And
when you say life-changing,
it was for me too.
What specifically about your life now has changed and is better because of the sale?
Well, you don't have to worry about money things on a day-to-day basis. I mean, that's a huge difference, right? So just personally, that removes the whole stress from your life. You know, I had a little bit of that from Crash Bandicoot. I worked on a game called Crash Bandicoot back in the 90s, and I actually didn't own equity in that company, Naughty Dog, but I did have a royalty on the game. So one thing it let me do is invest in ITA, actually. So part of the reason that I had shares in ITA when it sold was because I was kind of the angel investor, one of the two, in the beginning of that company.
And we'll talk about one of the strings that that came with investing in that company in a moment. But the reason that you were able to do it, to code and to angel invest and so on, seems to me that part of it goes back to something that you and your dad did together. Did you guys, here's what you told Jeremy Weiss in the pre-interview. I taught myself to code. I'd read source code listings out of a magazine.
That's right.
What is that?
Yeah, back in the day, in the 70s, you didn't have floppy drives. We did have floppy drives, but you didn't get software on floppy drives. You'd get these magazines like Creative Computing or Byte Magazine, and you'd just type in a basic program listing. And, you know, the thing about that was it would never work because the basic was a different dialect. And so it was a great learning experience. You'd have to figure out how to make it work. So I'd type in something that was meant for the Apple II on my Heathkit computer that my dad and I built. You know, I kind of helped as a 7-year-old. You know, you can imagine what that help was like. He really built it. And, you know, I type him in, and he often says now that he never got to use the computer after it was built because I just completely monopolized it.
You just knew that's the thing for you. What was it about the computer that made you feel, I want to sit and work on this thing?
It was like an infinite toy box. I mean, the thing that still really appeals to me about software is you can create something from nothing. And it's just such an amazing feeling to be able to literally imagine something and then make it. You know, it's like my son now plays Minecraft. I'm sure everybody knows about Minecraft. And, you know, I asked him, like, why don't you just go across the street and play with your friend Noah? Why do you play on Minecraft? And he said, but Dad, I can't build a giant building in the real world. You know, Minecraft, I can make a building. And, you know, software is just like that. It's all virtual. And the fact that it is means that, you know, someone like me, a 7-year-old kid, could make a game and actually see it come to life. And, of course, at that time, the games were really primitive. But it was still just magical this ability to create an infinite number of toys from this toy box.
But you did actually make a game at that age?
Yeah, I made little Space Invader type games, you know, mostly character graphics. I mean, they're really primitive, and I think the first program I actually sold was a game, and I was like 13. It was a little Space Invaders game for a basic programming book, and you know, so very, very primitive. And you know, one of the liberating things about that is that, you know, commercial games are really primitive too, because you just couldn't do that much with the hardware. So the gap between what I was able to do, you know, as a young teenager, and what was commercially available was not that big. And now I think it's a totally different world. You know, it's daunting, I guess, for kids now, because there's so much to learn to make anything that's even a basic app. And I just can't imagine what it's like to be, you know, someone like me when I was 7 now. And I think a lot about, you know, how should we teach kids how to program, you know, and how do we get kids to get excited about computers like I did?
And it seems like the answer is to get them to make something of their own as quickly as possible, something that was in their head and then is now out in the real world. That's the other part of you. You were selling. You actually sold your mom one of your early programs. What did you sell her?
Yeah, well, so my mom, actually, the reason that my dad built the computer wasn't for me to have a toy. Actually, okay. It was that my mom is a freelance writer. And so he told her, you know, hey, there are these things, computers now, and you can... you know, and she said, well, why do I want a computer? Why would I want that? And he said, well, you can just edit stuff on the screen. You don't have to retype it from scratch. And she was like, sold. Wow. So basically, you know, this very early word processing machine, it was meant for my mom to write her books. And indeed she did. But, you know, back then it's hard to imagine, but you know, even the idea that you would double space when you printed, or that you'd put a header and a footer and a page number on every page, the word processors didn't do that by default. They didn't come with that. That was like a fancy feature. So I would write her little programs that would take her documents and put headers and footers on. And I actually found recently a manual that I wrote for one of my programs. You know, I'm like this 12-year-old kid. I wrote a manual, and it's hilarious. I put my phone number, which was also her phone number, of course, in there, and said, if you have trouble, call this number for tech support. You know, so for me, it was like pretending to be a real software guy, you know, a real software producer. And I obviously must have really liked that at the time. That was part of it for me.
Did your dad get to see, is your dad around still?
Yeah, he is.
He is. So he got to see what you got to do with this. He was an electrical engineer who got you started. How did he feel when he saw you coding and producing and creating professionally?
I mean, I think it's probably just like any other, you know, kid with a talent. You're kind of at some level probably amazed by the talent, and you're also sort of dismayed by, you know, how much time it takes. I mean, because I just became absorbed in it to the point where I would spend all of my waking hours on it, and that was all the way through high school and then in college. And I think at some level, you know, they probably wondered, my parents, whether this is actually a good thing overall, that it's becoming this obsession. And yeah, but I think it was pretty gratifying for him to see that, you know, especially since I tell the story about building that computer with him. I mean, this was a Heath kit, which nobody's heard of anymore, I'm sure, mm-hmm. but they made ham radios and stuff. And so for this brief period in the 70s, they would sell you a kit computer, and not like a kit like you put, you know, the video card in. No, a kit like you solder every resistor onto the motherboard. And so since my dad was an electrical engineer, you know, he was able to do this, but I, you know, it took 6 months of, you know, every few days we'd work on it. And, you know, he'd say, get this color resistor out of the box. And I would go do that, and he'd solder it in. And I just thought the whole time, this is never going to work. My dad's gone crazy. This is just, you know, I'm humoring him while we're making this thing. And then after 6 months, you know, he turns this thing on for the first time, and this little prompt comes up. It was an H colon, because it was Heathkit, so H. And I was just amazed, like, oh my God, my father is a god. You know, wow. He can make this thing. I couldn't even imagine how this thing worked. And all of a sudden, it just booted up the first time. Just a magical moment for me.
I can't imagine that. My dad made kebabs.
Yeah, but you know, it's probably at some level, you still, there's a craft to that too, right? I mean, and so this idea that you'd use a soldering iron to make something.
I used to watch it. It would be like magic, because when I was a kid, I got the Radio Shack. I forget what they are, but you didn't need solder because there were springs that would attach the wires together, and I couldn't get that to work.
Yeah.
And I would have gone mad if I sat and I typed out every line of code from a magazine and it didn't work. For you, it wasn't something that would make you say, forget this, it doesn't work, they cheated me. It was an opportunity for you to say, something's a little off because I have a different basic than they do. What do I do to fix it?
Yeah, and I remember, you know, there were tough times, though. I remember one night when my parents went out and I had a babysitter or something. And, of course, the babysitter had to do nothing because I just sat on the computer all night. And I remember I typed this whole thing in and I hit some key and it erased everything. And it was like, just this absolute just shock and tragedy for me, though, you know. So, and I still remember it, you know, even though I was seven at the time, I still remember, like, oh my God, my program's all wiped out, and, you know, it's like a terrible, you know, thing. So, you know, it wasn't all, you know, I was still a kid, so I still remember that getting really frustrated and giving up and then coming back to it. So, you know, I certainly wasn't like, you know, robotic in my ability to deal with the challenges. But yeah, I mean, I would get these little basic programs and type them in and then try to figure out why they didn't work.
How did you get into creating games professionally?
Well, so that's a great story because I'd always made games, you know, as a semi-professional. I mean, I actually had a game development system that I made with a guy actually in Scotland, which we collaborated over the internet, and this is like, you know, mid 80s. So this is really early. We'd send, you know, text files back and forth over the internet that were just encoded binary. It was just, you know, very primitive file sharing. And we made this game development system, but, you know, it didn't really get traction. And, you know, so I was never really a real professional game developer. And then I was fortunate enough to get into the artificial intelligence lab at MIT for graduate school. Mm-hmm. And they have an orientation where once they've decided they want you, then they try to sell you on going there, you know, so they invite you up there. So the first day, literally the first day I'm there, the first guy I met was this guy, Andy Gavin. And I'm talking to him like, yeah, I really like making games. And he said, oh, I've sold 6 games. And he talked about, you know, I made this game for the Sega Genesis and it sold, you know, 70,000 copies. Wow. And I was like, wow, I guess that's what happens when you go to MIT. You meet someone who's been selling games. And he'd been selling games with his friend Jason since they were in 7th grade. And so, you know, these guys were just amazing. They sold 6 games commercially when they were kids. And I just thought, you know, these guys are, first of all, they were really great friends. And second of all, you know, they wanted me to be their first employee when they actually went out and did a AAA game. AAA is kind of the term for big budget, all the, you know, pull out all the stops, get a great team.
Okay.
Yeah, and now AAA games like $400 million, but then it was, you know, $1.5 million. So when they asked me to join them as their first employee, I bailed on my PhD and just left, and that was the beginning of my involvement with Naughty Dog and Crash.
Oh, wow. And then you were an employee who got royalties on the creation of the game.
Yeah, that's right.
I heard from Jeremy that Sony would fax you bug reports. We're talking about paper bug reports.
Yeah, that was, I mean, so we had, you know, 2 of us programming on the first game. I mean, it was just brutal because that's not nearly enough people. We had 7 on the team and 2 programmers. And so we were just working crazy hours. And towards the end, as you said, we would get bug reports from Sony. They had, you know, 60 testers in a room testing all day. And they would test all day, and then they would fax over these, you know, pages and pages and pages of bug reports. And so, you know, Andy would, you know, get them off the fax machine at 2 a.m, and we'd start slogging through bugs. I mean, it was brutal, but it was, you know, it was obviously one of those things that you remember forever, you know, because it's like unforgettable that you're there and it's the middle of the night and you're working on bugs and you got to ship the game in 2 weeks. And yeah, we used to get bug reports literally on the fax machine.
The shocking thing to me about that isn't just the fax machine. It's that there were people who were just paid to play games and look for errors in those games.
Oh, man. You think that's fun, but actually it's grueling.
Really?
After you play the same game 12 hours a day for 3 months, you start to go crazy.
And as you were doing this, there were other MIT, were they graduates at the time who were working on ITA?
Yeah, well, that started actually, yeah, around the same time we were working on Crash 1.
Mm-hmm. And what was the problem that they saw that made them say, it's time to create software?
Well, they looked at things like Saber. You know, and Saber was an incredibly impressive system developed in the 60s by IBM and American Airlines. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was built on mainframes. It hadn't changed much. It was still kind of based on this older technology stack of, you know, mainframes and a language called TPF. And in particular, the search function where if somebody, you know, a travel agent wanted to figure out on for a customer who called, because of course they would call on the phone, there was no internet yet, there were no internet sales of tickets yet, at least. So someone would call on the phone, they'd say, well, I want to go to Boston, I'm in LA, and the travel agent would type into this thing and it would do a search, right? It would figure out what are all the ways to go from LA to Boston and what do they cost. And at that time, it was all text-based systems. They weren't hooked up to anything like, you know, a TCP/IP connection that you would need for a website. And they did a really poor job. I mean, you would do something like Boston to LA and you'd get 9 answers all on United. You know, and it was kind of like, well, I know there's other airlines, so what happened to them?
Why didn't they show other airlines?
It was a hard problem. I mean, partly it was just, it's a really hard problem to come up with a representative set of solutions, because for any given query like that, I mean, if you look at something like a transatlantic U.S. flight like Boston to L.A., there's 1,000 reasonable ways to go Boston to L.A., and then, of course, there's 1,000 reasonable ways to come back. So that right there, before you even talk about prices, you've got 1,000,000 combinations you're looking at, and the challenge there is to figure out what all those 1,000,000 cost by applying the fare rules and making sure, you know, this fare can be used with that fare and so on, and then to provide kind of a summary of that search space is really, really challenging. And so the way all the systems worked then was they would use heuristics. They would say, well, it's kind of good to go through Chicago, so let's do some of those and see what they cost, like maybe out of Dallas or something. But it was all rules of thumb. It was this heuristic base. And so their insight, Jeremy Wertheimer started the company, and then Carl DeMarkin really came in and wrote the majority of the early system. Their insight was, you know, we can actually do a comprehensive job of this and actually find all the valid solutions and then actually take that huge space. And that, you know, the number of solutions in this case would be like 10 to the 32. I mean, giant, giant numbers. Mm-hmm. And then find a way to produce a summary that kind of covered that space and summarized it. And it was a very hard problem.
So is it that the raw data would say, if you want to go from LA to San Francisco, there's also a way of going from LA to New York to San Francisco, but you needed to figure out that should be excluded and others need to be included. Am I picking up on it?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there are trade-offs, right? So you might have an inconvenient itinerary where it's, you know, 2 stops, mm-hmm. but maybe just the way the fare rules work out, it's cheaper. So you still want to show that inconvenient $5 cheaper thing or $50 cheaper thing, right? So what you really need to do is you generate 1,000 outbounds, 1,000 returns, and you price all the 1,000,000 combinations. And then of those 1,000,000, you know, there's typically 1,000,000 ways to price a single itinerary, okay. because the fares are so complicated. It's just the airlines didn't intend to do this, but what they did was their rules are so flexible that the combinatorics are just absolutely staggering. And so you really want to look at all of these possible combinations, because you don't want to miss something good, but they're just a lot of them, a very
you know,
large number.
I wouldn't have thought. I it seems like it was just so easy to do that the only epiphany was that Carl said, hey, you know what, I can do it online, or Jeremy saw that the internet could be added somehow like magic. But now I'm seeing what you're talking about. And so if it's the two of them working, why do they need an investor? Why do they need money? Why can't they just continue to figure out this problem on their own?
Well, you know, I wanted to. So I actually knew Carl really well because he was my office mate at the AI lab, and we studied computational linguistics together. We were in the same group, had the same advisor. So I knew Carl, and I kind of knew what he was doing, and he showed me the early prototypes of the product. And I just thought, wow, this is really cool. I mean, basically what the state of the art is right now is 9 answers, and Carl's got this like 500 answer, you know, awesome, you know, prototype. And you know, I really wanted to be involved as an investor, and you know, Jeremy was very canny because he said, you can invest, but only if you also write code.
Like, that's part I was getting at before. You have to write code as an investor.
Like, we basically said, you know, I'm not going to let you invest just passively. You can invest, but then you also have to do work. Like, you got to help us. And, you know, very, very clever in that, you know, he needed both money and programming. So he basically, you know, got both of them at the same time. You know, I wasn't the only investor. I mean, his father put in a bunch of money, and eventually we actually got a deal done with a company called Amadeus, which was the European Sabre. So at that point, the company was self-sufficient. But at that early stage, I mean, it was just on Jeremy's credit card, you know, that kind of phase.
What did you envision for it? What did you see that made you say, I want to invest in it? And by the way, earlier when I said Inky, I accidentally slid my phone right into the garbage pail, which is always empty. So I'm going to pull it out. There it is. No, it's not empty. It also has the dry cleaning bag that this shirt came in. Phone is back.
There you go.
So what was your vision? What did you say, I want to be a part of this because I see the future. What's the future?
I thought it was a really interesting hard problem, and I thought that would be fun to work on. And we had no idea actually how hard it would be. Even though we knew it would be hard, we had no idea. It was this hubris of naivete, right? But I also thought, you know, Jeremy kind of just went through the numbers around the travel industry. And at that time, it was, you know, 2 billion flights a year. I mean, travel's huge. And if you look at the amount of commerce done, the dollar amount of travel, it's just vast. And indeed, now the travel sites are probably the biggest spenders on Google search, right? There's just enormous amounts of commerce involved in travel. So I thought, you know, the idea that we would be able to get some tiny, tiny fraction of that, I thought was a really compelling business opportunity. And, you know, now I would call it the total addressable market. You know, the total addressable market was really large for that space. I wasn't thinking of it that way at the time, but I think I could tell, you know, this is a big space. And also, I kind of like the idea of working on something that people would understand at some level, like games, people understand, travel, people, they may not know how it works, but they know, oh, I get it. When I go to orbit, something has to figure out how I get from point A to point B. Your software does that. And that's kind of gratifying.
This was 1997?
Yeah, 97, 98. I mean, they had a prototype by the end of 97.
Were you thinking this is going to power other websites, or were you thinking websites at all?
We were. I would like to say that the whole thing was planned from the beginning to take advantage of the shift of ticket distribution onto the internet. It wasn't nearly so sophisticated, but we did obviously know, you know, the internet. We knew, you know, we'd followed Netscape and things like that, and we knew the browser was starting to become important. And it really wasn't clear in 1995 yet, at least to me, how rapidly companies would adopt the internet. You know, I remember saying to somebody at the AI lab, yeah, this thing's going to take like 5 years at least, maybe 10, because, you know, companies have to be on this thing, otherwise no one's going to care. And like, how long is it going to take companies to get around to making websites? It's going to be a long time. And indeed, you know, it was like 8 months. And then every major company had a website. You know, it's fascinating how fast it happened. And so we knew about this and we knew it was going to happen, but I guess we didn't know how rapidly. And the other thing that was this kind of a structural opportunity that we weren't thinking about, but was a huge advantage for us, was because nobody was really selling many tickets on the internet yet, the airlines didn't care that much about that channel, which meant they were willing to trust a crazy company of MIT guys with their business on that channel because it was kind of de minimis. And so, you know, if we were in charge, if they were putting us in the middle of 75% of their ticket sales, they'd be really nervous, right? Unproven technology, squirrely guys from MIT. But the fact that it was a channel that was just starting to become relevant was really valuable because we could get in there and then all we had to do is not blow it, right? We could, as the channel exploded, we just had to grow and maintain our operational integrity as the volumes went up, and we kept the business. And so, you know, it's a really interesting lesson for entrepreneurs, I think, that usually when something like this happens, there's some structural opportunity that you end up taking advantage of. And I think a lot of successful entrepreneurs like to say, well, of course we thought about that from the beginning and we were geniuses, but you know, I'm not so sure that's true. In our case, it was we kind of had this insight, but it wasn't planned out from the beginning, you know.
Was there a minimum viable product?
Yeah, and actually one of the things that's fascinating about both travel search and email is the minimum viable product is really, really not minimal at all. And we took us a long time in both cases to learn what that minimal product was and to get to it.
What is a minimum viable product? It can't be as easy as I will manually do it for them. What does Eric Ries call it? The concierge MVP, which is the simplest, it seems, of all the MVPs. What did it have to include?
Yeah, I mean, for travel search, it's you think, well, I mean, if I talk to a programmer who doesn't know anything about travel, but they're a good programmer, they'll typically say something like, well, isn't looking up the price like a database transaction? They assume that there's just a price somewhere you look up. And in fact, it's much more like assembling a million-piece jigsaw puzzle for every query. You know, it's lots of combinations of fares, and fares have rules that say, well, I'm allowed to be used as long as there's queue availability, but I can't be used if this other fare is used, and I also can't be used on Tulsa trips, and I also can't be used between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. You know, so there's just these rules that go along, and there's hundreds and hundreds of fares in each market. So the minimum viable product was one where you read in all these rules. You read in all the fare data, which was not trivial. It wasn't easy to read the fares. It wasn't like rocket science hard, but it was slogging to figure out how do you just interpret this data. Originally, they would give it to us on big mag tapes, like literally those tapes you see in old Star Trek episodes, the big tape drives.
They would ship those to you. You'd have to put them on like an old tape deck looking thing, up on a reel-to-reel looking thing.
Yeah.
And then you'd pull out all the data. So it wasn't even up to date.
No, and then it was just test data too, right? I mean, so in the beginning, it was, you know, these big. We had to write a device driver for Linux to talk to this Kennedy tape drive. I mean, so there was that kind of scut work around just getting the data and understanding it, and you know, that was a decent amount of work. But you know, to have a real minimal viable product for travel search, you've got to do all that rule validation properly. There's like thousands of different kinds of rules that the airlines have. I mean, people know about things like Saturday stay restriction and that sort of thing, but there's just thousands of these things and lots and lots and lots of detail. And, you know, long story short, it basically took 5 years to get all this stuff.
5 years to get to the MVP.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's similar with email. I mean, email, people don't think about it either, but there's just vast amounts of complexity. I like to call it a fractal problem, because the more detail you get into, the more you realize, oh, there's all this stuff I didn't even know I had to do. And the thing that I think is interesting from a lean startup standpoint is, how do you think about a lean startup in the context of a five-year MVP? You know, because not all software problems are equally difficult. Some are harder than others. How do you fund something that where it takes 5 years to get to the MVP? And I think these are really interesting questions for the startup philosophy, you know, the kind of Eric Ries lean startup kind of narrative.
So if you have an MVP that takes 5 years, presumably, the reason you have an MVP is to show to a customer and say, hey, is this what you guys were looking for? Yes or no? And then if it's not, I'll go back and even if it is yes, I'll go back and tweak it. Can you take back and tweak something that you spend 5 years creating? Can you get back and adjust it?
Yeah, and you know, to be fair, we weren't waiting 5 years before we showed it to anybody. I mean, we were showing it to airline people the whole time. But it's just that it wasn't really viable in terms of being usable by any of them.
Amadeus did not use it until 5 years later.
They kind of, there are other reasons for that. I mean, there were kind of internal conflicts within Amadeus about whether they should use our engine or their own. So they didn't really end up using it, but not for that reason. But let's say somebody like, American Airlines, someone like that, they would give us feedback and they would say, wow, this is really cool and this is going to be great, but you're getting all of our prices wrong. Because you're not doing these rules properly. And so it would be, you know, we could show them something that was, it kind of looked and felt like the end product, but it wasn't really minimally viable. And that's really true of email too. You can make an email client in a weekend, but it's not actually usable. It's not really minimally viable because no one can actually use it instead of mail.app or Outlook, right? That's another multiple year effort to get to that point.
There's one company that I saw that did that, Triage. It seemed like that was an MVP where all you could do is reply or archive.
Yeah, and the problem with that is that what we found, at least with email, is people won't use multiple email apps. So you either wholesale replace the thing that they're using, or they're just not going to use it. And so, you know, there are services where they're like, well, we'll help you unsubscribe from mailing lists. The problem with those is they can't become someone's primary mail client, and most people don't want to use multiple mail solutions. They want to have the thing that comes on their phone or an alternative app which replaces that, and that's it. And so every single thing that a mail client does, you got to cover somehow, whether it's things like attachments or, you know, the handling of drafts or, you know, and there's still things that people say, you know, they want out of Inky that we don't have yet. that are on our list to work on. So, you know, minimum viable is kind of, there's sort of minimum thing to show to somebody, engage market reception to it. And then there's minimum viable from the standpoint of someone could actually use this instead of another alternative. And they're really different for something like a mail client or a travel search engine.
Your first client was Orbitz, 2001.
They were the first, they were kind of our marquee client. They were the first ones that really put it into production. We also had an airline called America West, which people may not remember, but they sort of evolved into U.S. Airways, and now Doug Parker runs American. He was the guy who started America West, or the CEO at the time. And, so we had America West and Orbitz, and, you know, there again, it was a fortuitous opportunity because Orbitz really needed something differentiated from Expedia and Travelocity. And there we were with this new fancy search engine that did different stuff and produced a very different looking kind of output. So again, a lot of what makes things successful, I think, is being in the right place at the right time with the right stuff. And so that was the right place at the right time because of Orbitz and their need for something at that time that was differentiated.
Wasn't Orbitz founded by the airlines?
Yeah, so Orbitz was founded by the airlines as a way to try to challenge Travelocity and Expedia so that those two entities wouldn't have too much leverage over the airlines.
So did it make it easier for you to get them as a client knowing that, well, you were collecting their data, they'd seen what you'd done with their data, and so they trusted it more also?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we could ever get the majors without that. I mean, I don't know. I'd like to think that we would win them over. But certainly the idea that we were powering Orbitz and already pricing all their stuff properly for consumers, you know, that's kind of like they get to try before they buy, you know, and that was a huge benefit to us to be able to do that. And, you know, and Orbitz, we gave them an incredibly, incredibly good deal. So it's not like they gave us that privilege for free.
Did you try to sell to others before Orbitz and get turned away?
Yeah, I mean, we had a really long interaction with Delta, starting, I mean, probably even 97, 98. And, you know, there, it wasn't the right time for Delta to use an external system. We weren't really ready in the sense that we weren't at that minimum viable product level. And, you know, so they would say, well, you're pricing all this stuff wrong. And they're right. I mean, we were pricing a lot of stuff wrong. And it took a long time for us to code in all the rules and then, you know, all the little edge cases. I mean, like one thing I like to talk about is these edge cases are, let's say the fare requires a Saturday stayover and you cross the international date line and it was Friday on both, so, you know, you basically left Friday and arrived Friday. Well, did you have a Saturday stay or not? I mean, so there's all these, when you get into real world and time zones and time and things like that, you get a lot of crazy edge cases. And it just takes a long time to figure out the industry's answers to those, because it's not like anybody wrote those things down. And so, yeah, we had an early engagement with Delta that ended up failing, essentially, and it was incredibly painful, and, you know, all the usual things that one could say about that. But I mean, we learned a lot from it, but it would be much better for us if we'd, you know, gotten them as a customer.
And I just realized I forgot to say that my sponsor, or to give the sponsor spot for Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I say all the time that entrepreneurs who get started should get their company in order before they get into anything serious. Don't save that till later. I talked to entrepreneur. In fact, just before we talked, a half hour before, I finished a conversation with an entrepreneur whose co-founders just left her right as she was getting going. Situations like that come up. You need to be prepared. And the way to prepare is by talking to a lawyer early on, setting up the paperwork early on, and allowing yourselves to, when the problem happens, to not just deal with just the problem, not both the problem and the legal issues that go along with how do you separate, how do you make sure that the person who you now hate doesn't own half your company for the rest of your life. All those things come up. Talk to someone who's seen them many, many times. That's the person who I'm recommending you talk to, Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Frankly, he'll help you get started, but that's not where he focuses. His big focus is on those big transactions, the buyout, the sale, the raising money. That's where he comes through for you. That's what he's experienced in. But of course, he wants to help you get started if that's where you are. Go check him out at walkercorporatelaw.com. David, this, by the way, do you prefer to be called David or Dave?
Dave's fine either Dave. Way.
Was it awkward when I called you so formally at the top of the interview, David?
No, it's okay. Not awkward. it doesn't matter to me.
I said, you know what? I don't know the guy well enough yet. I saw that your executive assistant referred to you as Dave. I said, all right, that's for her. I haven't yet gotten to know him on that level. So, Dave, it seems like everything's just falling into place for you. Your dad set you up, right, by showing you how to set up a computer. That setting up a computer, frankly, at all is possible, but helped you learn to code. Then you coded. Then you created a great game that did well. Then you got into this. Was there any challenge along the way, or was it all as easy and simple and straightforward as it seems?
Well, I mean, certainly, and don't forget that was 1977, too, so very few people actually had access to a computer, and I remember I heard Max Levchin on, I think he was on NPR talking about this, you know, there was a whole generation of us who were just lucked into having access to these devices so early in our lives and early in the timeline of this yep. stuff. So, you know, that was certainly incredibly lucky, fortuitous, and all good. You know, I will say there's been, you know, a series of really difficult challenges. I mean, for example, with Crash, we had no idea that was going to be Sony's mascot game. And if it hadn't been, we would have sold 100,000 copies instead of tens of millions. It's just as simple as that, right? I mean, so every one of these cases where it's been successful, there's been a right place, right time element to it. And in every one of these, there's been just tremendous amounts of slogging. I mean, that's the thing that people don't see.
What do you mean by slogging?
Just thousands of hours of doing boring stuff. I mean, like, with, for example, the airline data, there's, you think about, you know, for example, something as simple as time. You know, there's obviously a flight departure time. Well, that's local time. So then there's a time zone thing where it says, you know, how many hours off of GMT is
this? I see. So what you're saying is it's not so much that you got a client who turned around and cut off relations with you, or something dramatic happened where you got everything up and running and then the whole business came crashing down. And it's not that kind of challenge. The challenge of the slog, of sit down there, you have a difficult problem, don't get up until you do it, until you solve it, and then when it seems like the solution is great, but it and turns out not to be great, you have to go back and do the work. It's do the work type of challenge.
Yeah, and that's partly, I think, because of the domains I've worked in. I mean, both travel and email have this, they're characterized by a lot of this kind of data and detail and slogging. I mean, mm-hmm. and you know, I'll just give you a sense of this with travel. So aviation taxes. Right, you know, when you look at your ticket, you pay $9.11 fee, and you pay, you know, departure fee, and there's all those little taxes. Well, you know, ITA, we had to create a little tax language, and that file of tax rules for aviation taxes for the world was like 100,000 lines. So, I mean, someone typed in, a bunch of people typed in 100,000 lines of essentially tax code to properly encode all the aviation taxes. And by the way, if every country in the world changes their aviation taxes once a year, you're looking at a change or two a day. So you're not just doing it once, you've got to constantly update it. And you know, similarly with email, there's, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 mail servers, and they all behave slightly differently. Mostly they behave the same, but there are little quirks. And so you got to slog through figuring out what are the quirks, you know. So there's a lot of this kind of manual data entry stuff that I think a lot of developers or just people in general who work on hard problems, they could feel like it's beneath them, it's boring, and you know, every single thing I've worked on involved a lot of that. Even with Crash, I mean, I remember manually tuning every single turtle in the game. You know, the turtles that move around, I mean, someone had to go in and, you know, tune every turtle in the whole game.
What does tuning a turtle mean?
It means, you know, the turtle walks across the path and it has to be timed right so that the gameplay works well and it's fun and it's not too hard and the camera's not in the wrong place for you to see the obstacle. And, you know, there's little values you set for each turtle in the whole game.
Sometimes I feel like all that kind of slogging, isn't that what big successful people just give their interns to do? Isn't there? Don't you just say to an intern, here's the tax law, go do it?
I don't think so. I think most of the people who are hugely successful have done tremendous amounts of slogging. I think that it's not something that the media focuses on, and it's not something people talk about, but I know that the early Google people did a tremendous amount of slogging. I mean, they were working like 100-hour weeks just like we were. Every one of these things that's substantive requires a lot of slogging, and I don't think it's easy to delegate it because you know, imagine that tax file. You know, you maybe you can give that to an intern, but it's not. You kind of have to have the domain knowledge, right? You can't.
Yes, I was thinking, yes, maybe you can give it to an intern, but if things screw up, oh boy, that's horrible.
Right.
You don't want to screw up taxes. And then
you really don't
want to
screw up taxes. Yeah, you really don't want to screw up taxes.
Hey, you were COO until 2007. Then I think after that you became a board member, right? Or you stayed just a board member, right?
That's right, yeah.
Why did you take a step back from day-to-day operations?
I mean, honestly, part of it was just kind of burnout. I mean, I and other people on the senior management team had been doing multiple jobs each until we raised money. We raised a bunch of money in 2006, and we brought in a lot of management help. And that was, you know, a challenge in some ways because we had to figure out how do we transfer all this knowledge to these new people? How do we transfer the kind of cultural values to the new people? But obviously, you know, doing one job is much easier than doing five. And also I did a lot of travel and a lot of kind of technical sales where I was trying to convince people to give us data that we needed. And it was just a lot of hard work, and there was an element of burnout to it. And so there was an opportunity when we raised money for me to kind of take a step back and not take a break so much, but just kind of figure out what I wanted to do next.
And so you were thinking about what to do next before the sale to Google, which happened, I think it was 3 years later. Right.
Yeah. 2010. So the Google sale was 2010, and then we went through this whole process with the Department of Justice for almost a year. So it didn't really close until 2011.
I remember that. You know what? The first thing I remember thinking when the sale happened was, "Who are these guys? You mean Orbitz doesn't just go to the airlines and do it all themselves?"
All right. Yeah. Nobody knew who we were.
No.
I mean, we were pretty well known in the travel industry, but certainly the high profile that Google had, and so therefore when they acquired us, the profile we got made people realize, well, who are these guys? How can something I never heard of be worth $700 million
and impact so much of the stuff that I use, and I still didn't know that it existed?
Yeah, and I mean, we maintained a really low profile because we were mostly focused on selling stuff to businesses. Our customers were airlines and travel intermediaries, and to a large extent, they didn't really want us to have a high profile. It wasn't beneficial to them, so we kept a pretty low profile.
Why did you guys sell?
You know, there's a point in every business where you can double down on the risk, or you can exit, or you can raise money. Basically, those are your three options generally. And I think with any business, there's a point where you look at it and say, for us to take this to the next level, you know, what will we have to do? And so around 2005, we realized for us to really take it to the next level and long-term defend ourselves against competition from the Sabres of the world, we would need to build our own reservation system and start hosting airlines. We would have to not just be a search provider, we would have to provide the whole platform for a major airline. And so that's the reason we raised money. It's because we wanted to start this reservation system effort and get to parity. And obviously, parity is the first step, and then you go beyond it, right? I mean, we thought we'll bring web technology and sort of 21st century thinking to this reservation problem as well. And indeed, we did. Ultimately, you know, it became very difficult to get a customer and keep them in that space. And so at some point, we kind of thought, well, you know, we can keep trying to do this reservation system thing and then have the risk of the attack from below. And, you know, other guys were not sitting still. They were doing better search, you know, they were making their search engines better. They would underprice us. And, of course, the problem that you have if you're a new entrant like we were and you have only part of the offering is the other guys can bundle. So they can say, well, search is just free as long as you host on me, right? And so we started to see very strong signals from our customers that they were getting that kind of pitch. In other words, that, you know, our competitors were starting to compete on the basis of lower distribution fees or, you know, lower hosting fees. And so, you know, we don't have those things, so we had no way to really compete with that. And I don't think that was necessarily fatal, but it's the kind of calculation you have to make when you look at the state of the business and say, do I exit now? Do I partner with somebody? or do I double down and try to make, you know, try to go after these other competitors? And at just some point, you make the decision one way or the other, and that's what you do.
So you did it. You sold to Google. You rocked our world for a while on the outside, and obviously your life was changed because of it. And then I wonder, why email? And it had something to do with your inbox when you were at ITA.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting 800 to 1,000 emails a day, even as early as, you know, 2004. So I was kind of on the leading edge of this inbox overload problem. And I also, you know, I have a background in computational linguistics. I mean, so I had done work on text understanding, which seemed highly relevant to the inbox overload problem. You know, the idea that obviously a human is not going to be able to deal with 1,000 messages a day. It's just preposterous that a person's going to be able to do that. So it was pretty obvious even back then that you would need to have some AI or some kind of agent that would work on your behalf to triage a lot of it for you. And at the same time, I saw nobody doing anything like that. No one is even just not even thinking about it. And so the client tools that people had, you know, Outlook and Lotus Notes and yeah, Gmail is starting to get traction they were still kind of the way they were in the 90s. They hadn't changed much. And yet the volume was just massively increasing. And if I looked at the addressable market again, you're talking 4 billion people use email. I mean, it's just absolutely ubiquitous. And so it was very compelling to me. At the same time, I realized that it was a really, really hard problem. So the thing that I really tried to gauge, and whether I was right or not, we'll see, was, can a startup actually do something to fix this? Or is it too hard? You know,
but weren't you thinking, I'm looking at the first version. The first version was a cloud-enabled desktop app for all your mail, and it was for Mac only. I would be worried that Google would jump in there and make it all browser-based. That you weren't scared of Google?
Well, of course, you're always thinking about, I don't know if scared is the right word, but you're always thinking about the competitors. I mean, one of the interesting things, though, is that mail solutions by the big companies were already ubiquitous, and they still are. You know, so it wasn't like we were going to be surprised and, oh my God, now Google has mail. I mean, they've always had it, right? So I mean, as long as we've been in the business. And so, of course, it's daunting, but it's kind of like when we looked at travel and said, well, you know, Sabre's like a multi-billion-dollar market cap company with lots of really smart people, and we didn't view that as a hopeless fool's errand to try to compete with them. At the same time, we also weren't naive, like, well, this is going to be easy. and I think with a space like email, the risk is much greater and the reward is much greater, in the sense that it's closer to a core capability for someone like a Google or an Apple. They care a lot about it, probably not as much as they care about things like their core business, but they care about it. And so clearly it's something highly hyper-competitive. And the other thing that was clear even when I just looked at the space in 2007 was, you know, these guys have worked really hard to devalue the products to essentially zero for consumers. And that's another barrier, right? I mean, if you can't charge for something, that's challenging. So, but I also thought that, you know, if you could move the needle at all for 4 billion consumers, that would be really, really cool. Like, you would have a lot of opportunity to make an impact that way. And that's,
I feel like,
what
it's
I
one
wanted.
Of the biggest problems we have in common, all of us who are online, that it's the amount of email that we get in. I tried for about 7 months to just stop checking email. And I said,
yeah,
that's it.
Luck.
I actually had a responder that said, I have a team of people at Mixergy who will respond. I can't touch this anymore. If you need any help, go to mixergy.com/contact. It didn't work. There are too many things that I needed to break that rule for.
Yeah, it's too hard. I mean, you know, and email is just so ubiquitous. It's the only thing that really works between arbitrary people on, you know, nobody has to be signed up. Everybody has a mail account. And that ubiquity was really appealing to me. And also just the level of brokenness and frustration was really compelling to me.
So here's the thing. If we just say email, I don't think people are going to get the significance of it. If we say just lump it together, I'm opening up my phone right now. I think there's something special about this. And then I'll talk about something that I think the audience is going to be worried about too. What's special about it is the swipe gestures to get to what you need. What's special about it is the ability to respond. When I say respond faster, It's not just that the respond button is closer. It's what I say to respond. It's shortcuts.
Right. One-click reply and things like you can unsubscribe in one click from a mailing list, and Inky knows what the mailing list mail is versus mail from, you know, your friends. And this idea that the mail that comes in is actually categorized for you, I think, is a huge...
Categorized in what way? What kind of categories?
Well, for example, social. You know, if it's a social message, you can look at your filtered inbox and not see that stuff. And then when you want to look at the social messages, go into the social smart view. So Inky moves things around for you and categorizes them, and you can choose to see them filtered out or not. But the point is that Inky helps you by identifying what things, what the intent of a message is, and kind of what kind of message it is.
So isn't that something now that Gmail has started doing?
They have started doing it, and I think one thing that we like to say is we work well with Gmail, and we also happen to work with everything else. So, I mean, if you're one of the 3.5 billion people that has has mail somewhere other than Gmail, you know, we can give you the same kind of auto classification capability for your accounts too. And I think also, I mean, we have a different approach. And for example, we separate out your packages, and so you can see you could search for hashtag package and see all your packages, or go in the package smart view and look in there, and it'll say for each one the package tracking. You know, so it goes and finds the package tracking status for you on the shipper's website and puts it right in there. So, you know, it's true that the intent, I think, of Gmail's tabs is similar. I think the devil's in the details at some level, though.
It is a very Mac-like experience here. So here's the one issue that I have, and I'd want to talk to you about it. Security. Mm-hmm. I worry about giving my email to another company. And I know that from talking to the team internally here that you've thought of that.
Yeah, and it's a really fascinating issue, because I almost, out of a sense of obligation baked into the whole plan, preservation of privacy. And the interesting thing from a market or entrepreneurial standpoint is I'm not sure that it actually matters for market share. I'm not sure that the vast majority of people will vote with their feet for something that preserves their privacy. But you know, what we do is Inky processes all the mail on your device. So your device is either an iPhone or an iPad, or it's a Windows desktop, or it's a Mac desktop, but it's your device using your network card to talk to your mail server, using your CPU to process it. And we never see the mail. The mail's never touching our system. And that's just baked into the architecture. And we did that precisely because I don't want to have the ability for any of my employees ever to be able to read people's email. I just don't want it.
That's the part I didn't know. So actually, that's one of the parts I didn't know. I didn't know about Inky before. I knew about you.
I mean, it's pretty new, and I think, you know, we've been on desktop for a while, but the mobile version on iOS has only been out for a few weeks, and clearly all of the interest around applications is now centered around mobile. And so, you know, we had desktop out, but no one was really paying much attention, and that it was kind of good in a way, because it let us iterate in plain view with a bunch of loyal users to get that core engine right.
By doing it, I actually do. I hate that I do, but I do still care about desktop. I still need to be able to check email, only email on desktop. Everything else I'd love to just do on my phone. But I see the product. It looks beautiful. It looks like you guys have spent a lot of time on it. I didn't know about it until Steve Young told me about it. He said, look, you got to check this out. And then he made the introduction to you. And then I had this issue with security, which I like. I like that the email is all processed on my phone. It used to be that that's the way it was. It used to be that if you wanted to install anything from your Dora on up to mail, it was just processing on your desk. And then all these other companies decided that they want to process your email in the cloud. And I don't know how other people do it. They give access to their email to a third party, and then another and another, and I still worry about that.
Well, I think actually that you're legitimately worried about it. And it's not just the company. It's also, you know, law enforcement. It's, you know, any entity that has the right to get access to the data. If the data is stored somewhere in the cloud, they can get it, right? So I think in the post-Snowden era, this is a whole complex set of issues.
And you're right that for some reason people don't care about it. I don't know why they care about it when it comes to a search to a search engine, but not when it comes to email. They care about it when it comes to the search engine, but go look in the App Store for email that promises security, or go look in the App Store for a notepad that promises encryption, true encryption. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, and most of those things, they don't get any traction because no one cares. And
no one's
even, but it's not clear to me, though, whether no one cares or whether it just isn't a viable alternative yet. And the other thing I've observed with security, it's fascinating. I mean, there's all kinds of egghead details about how we do the security, and we use this technique called zero-knowledge proofs, and my academic advisor at MIT literally invented this stuff, and so I really wanted to use it in this context. And it allows us to store data on your behalf encrypted in such a way we can't decrypt it. And it's really mind-bending, and people have a lot of...
Do you do that? Does the data come off my phone and into your system and you encrypt it?
We do for your credentials, for your accounts, because we want it to be the case that you set up Inky once, and then anytime you install it on a new device, whether it's a desktop or a mobile or whatever, it knows about all your accounts. And so we want to store your account credentials, but we want to store them encrypted so that we can't read them. And so it's kind of counterintuitive that we can do that, but we actually can do that. But one of the things that I found that's fascinating about this security stuff is the people who care about security, ironically, they're never happy with any of the answers you give them either. So the services that try to cater to the security conscious, they don't win the security conscious people over either, because there's always this kind of sense that, well, that's not good enough.
You know what? That's a good point. You tell them that this app doesn't take the data off your computer and send it into the cloud at all. They say, well, what if another app is on your computer? As soon as you're on the computer, some other app could take the data, and you prove to them that that's not possible, and they say, what if someone's looking over your shoulder? You're right. I get that.
Right, and you know, we end up with this kind of, well, unless it's open source, I don't trust anything, and then I don't know what to say to that.
Right. I'm not going to make it open source. And I wouldn't blame you if you took away that security feature. I know that I care about it. I'd love other people to care about it, and I accept that they just don't.
We're not going to take it away because I care about it personally, and okay. I think it's a public good. I think privacy is a public good. What I'm saying is that may just be, from a purely Machiavellian business standpoint, that may just be stupid. You know, we may just be doing that, and it may actually be hurting us. But I'm just going to do it anyway because I think it's important. But the irony is, you know, it doesn't win me any points with the security conscious anyway. So I'm not sure.
You know what, though? Gabriel from DuckDuckGo.
It makes me feel better than nobody else.
I got emails from Gabriel from DuckDuckGo going back years and years back when some of this stuff just felt like a quixotic adventure to try to fight Google on security issues. And today, he's making a dent. He's getting a piece of the market. Not a huge one yet, but it shows that maybe raising awareness of the issue and fighting for it could help.
Yeah, and I think also people have to develop trust in your company and your brand, and it's obvious that they don't know who you are in the beginning. They're not necessarily going to trust you. So there's a hurdle you have to get over where you can say things to people and they just intrinsically believe them at some level, as opposed to you're just some company they've never heard of. I think they intrinsically disbelieve you.
Yes, and yes.
Like, what's the catch? I mean, one of the things we get all the time, which is just it's frustrating and funny, people say, I'm not going to trust your app because it's free, right? So then there's a catch. Like, well, but if we asked you to pay for it, you wouldn't pay for it.
Right, and you wouldn't.
You know, you don't pay for Gmail.
How are you going to make money if the app is free?
I mean, the goal for us is to take this same core engine and do things for small businesses and companies. And also, you know, even consumers. I think, you know, consumers that are high, you know, power users of email, I think our hope is eventually people will understand the benefit and will actually pay. But if you're the new entrant and you're trying to attack from below and the price is zero, there's no below. Right? So you can't go out of the gate with that. You know, so ultimately, I think we'll find ways to monetize it, charging people for it. But you can't lead with that with consumers. You got to get consumer traction first, and then have people spread the word about it. And, you know, we'll also do things like you see in the app stores with games, all the games are free and there's in-app purchases. So we'll do stuff like that too. We'll have things that you can buy in the app that make it that tailored to certain audiences.
I can see that. All right. And even though security's in there, I don't think anyone else cares about it. And that's not the reason to go and check out the app. It's all the functionality that makes the nightmare that is email, that tames it, that makes it more bearable, that makes it easier to deal with. And it's all available at, I love this domain. It's just Inky, Inky.com.
Yeah. And the Inky name was a long time coming. I mean, we worked forever, it seems, on trying to come up with a name that was memorable, easy to pronounce, easy to spell. We could get the .com. We could trademark the name for, you know, in our space. And I kind of like the idea of writing or ink or something involving communication, but communication spanning the millennia. I'm really proud of the name. I think people initially find it odd, like, why is there a weird octopus? What does that have to do with mail?
And I thought that was because of the ink.
I think ultimately people will get that. If you look at something like mint.com, it's similar. At first people are like, what does mint have to do with anything? Like, oh, mint, like a mint, money. And then the logo is a little sprig of mint. You get it over time, but it has to kind of bake for a while in people's minds. And I think Inky has that character. And I'm really proud of the name and the brand.
Cost you a lot to get Inky.com. That's a great domain.
It was one of those weird things where we lucked out, and it was like $2,500, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. I see. It was just parking there someone parked it at GoDaddy for a while.
Yeah, it was a guy who had a print shop called Inky Do. And he had it on Cedo, one of the domain brokers. And I emailed him and said, we're willing to buy it for your ask. And he said, well, if you pay me today, it's yours. It's like literally PayPal of the money that day.
It's totally worth it. That's a great domain name.
Yeah, people have asked us to buy it for $100,000. I mean, so it's just the domain alone, I think, is we really lucked out on that.
I see him. He's a guy in Illinois.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on here. Congratulations on all your success with ITA and on Inky and all the success with Inky, and for not spying on our email.
Hey, thanks. My pleasure to be here, and I will never allow any spying on you.
I appreciate it. All right. Well, thanks so much. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.